Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the move by a federal judge in Texas to block the implementation of President Obama's executive action on immigration due to begin on Wednesday. Nicholas Espiritu, a staff attorney with the National Immigration Law Center, joins us. He is on an amicus brief before the court in Texas versus United States, and we will discuss this highly political and partisan decision that will be appealed by the Justice Department and is likely to make its way to the Supreme Court, as well as the apparent collusion between the Republican-appointed judiciary and the Republican Congress, who have dug a hole for themselves by threatening to shut down the government over defunding the Department of Homeland Security, but have now been rescued by a partisan judge. In the same way, the conservatives on the Supreme Court are expected to rule in favor of gay marriage in order to rescue the Republicans from their increasingly unpopular stance on same-sex marriage that is likely to hurt them in the 2016 elections. Then we will speak with Dr. Helen Caldicott, a physician, author, and anti-nuclear activist who founded Physicians for Social Responsibility and was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize by Nobel laureate Linus Pauling. She is organizing a major international symposium in New York on the fourth anniversary of the Fukushima disasters, and we will discuss the costly and continually deadly legacy of the nuclear meltdowns in Japan, as well as the potential for similar disasters from accidents with the same power reactors here in the United States, and her new book, just out, Crisis Without End, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Catastrophe. Joining us now is Nicholas Espiritu, who's a staff attorney with the National Immigration Law Center, where he focuses on promoting the rights of low-income immigrants through litigation and administrative advocacy. He is on the amicus brief before the court in Texas versus the United States and has litigated several other cases that deal with immigration issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Espiritu.
Thank you very much for having me here.
And the case that we're talking about here is a spanner in the works, if you will, that's been thrown by the U.S. District Judge Andrew Hanen in Brownsville, Texas, that essentially just before President Obama's executive actions to allow the parents of children born here in the United States to stay on a temporary basis, that was supposed to go into effect on Wednesday. And now it's being held up by this judge who, well, let's start with the judge. He was appointed by George W. Bush. Is he a conservative? You know, the conservatives in this country have always talked about judicial activism, but there's nothing more of a judicial activist than the five conservatives on the Supreme Court and presumably a bunch of them in the federal judiciary. So let me begin with that question.
We definitely know from Judge Hanen's previous decisions that he vehemently disagrees with the current president's immigration policies and has expressed that unnecessarily in other opinions. And we believe that despite the judge's opinions, he's required to follow the law, and we just believe that he has gotten the key legal questions wrong in this case.
So this, though, does seem like, I mean, I don't know whether you read the piece recently by Linda Greenhouse, who's the longtime Supreme Court watcher at the New York Times, who has always been extremely fair and given the Supreme Court the benefit of the doubt. And she was listing some of the decisions that have come out of the conservative majority, particularly Citizens United and the voting rights, striking down the important provisions in the Voting Rights Act. And she's sort of coming to the conclusion that perhaps these five conservatives who dominate the Supreme Court are, in fact, political activists in robes. And just without casting aspersions on anybody here, the fact that the Republicans have got themselves into a knot on Capitol Hill with the House basically about to shut down the government again by defunding Homeland Security in order to stop what they consider Obama's overreach in his immigration efforts or in his efforts to reform immigration. You now have, in effect, this judge is getting the Republicans off the hook, isn't he? Because they've really dug a hole for themselves.
Well, the judge definitely cited ideologically with those in Congress who wish to stop any real reform happening. The president's actions were good, common sense actions that focused immigration resources and really allowed U.S. citizen children, and these new policies would have allowed U.S. citizen children and legal permanent resident children to not be separated from their families, would have allowed other immigrants who had been here for a long time and had long-standing ties to the community to continue to make valuable contributions to their communities. And we don't think that as a matter of law or as a matter of policy, the decision of this judge in Texas makes any sense, either for the individuals directly affected or the nation at large.
So his ruling comes just one day before undocumented immigrants were set to begin applying for work permits and legal protections. And the White House has had to delay carrying out President Obama's, or the administration's had to delay carrying out President Obama's executive actions on immigration because of this federal judge's ruling. Now, the head of Homeland Security has vowed to appeal the court rulings, but what's the timeline on that, Nicholas Espiritu?
It's very difficult to judge what the exact timeline is going to be. There's a number of different avenues that the federal government could take in terms of trying to expedite the appeals process, and we're very hopeful that the federal government will vigorously pursue these appeals and pursue these expedited timelines. We could see a request to stay the district court's opinion occur in the next couple days, and we could see a ruling on that request shortly. However, the appeals process could also take several months as well. It's just difficult at this time to know the exact timeline of what the federal government is going to do or the timeline of what the court is going to do.
And again, I'm speaking with Nicholas Espiritu, who is a staff attorney with the National Immigration Law Center, where he focuses on promoting the rights of low-income immigrants through litigation and administrative advocacy. He is on the amicus brief before the court in Texas versus United States and has litigated several other cases that deal with immigration issues. Now, the U.S. District Judge in Brownsville, Judge Andrew Hanen, has cited a number of states' attorney generals who have joined him, or he's joined their opinion, I guess. But on the other side, I guess on your side, there are also a number of states' attorney generals who support what the president's doing. So give us a breakdown on the forces arrayed on both sides here.
On the side of Texas and 25 other states which have sued the federal government, there's also a number of generally very conservative Congress folks, as well as some national organizations that we do not believe have the interests of immigrant communities in mind. Against them, we have civil rights, immigrants' rights, and union groups who have spoken up as to why these policies are both good law and good policy. And our group, the National Immigration Law Center, is one of those. But we also have states like California, Washington, and numerous others throughout the country, cities and localities, including major metropolitan centers that have very large immigrant populations, like Los Angeles and New York, as well as law enforcement agencies throughout the country who realize that as a matter of public safety and as a matter of ensuring that the rights of the individuals who would have benefited from these programs can be more adequately protected. All these groups have come together to really emphasize to the court that these policies are good for their communities and are encouraging the courts to uphold the president's policies.
So could it be, though, that much of this attack on President Obama's attempt to reform our broken immigration policy, and he's often said, the president's often said, look, I had to step in here because you, the Congress, simply won't deal with this issue. You know, this has been on the basically festering in Congress for almost a decade now. And it was, you know, there were serious attempts to reform immigration under President George W. Bush, which were ultimately stalled and have been stalled since. So I'm wondering whether how ideologically driven this is, whether this is a part of what they call the sort of Obama derangement syndrome, that conservatives just are so hateful towards this president that they just make up stuff like he doesn't have a birth certificate and he's a Kenyan and a revolutionary and a socialist and all of this crazy stuff that we've been hearing for so long. Because I frankly do not understand when Boehner and these other conservative congressmen get up and the Tea Partiers get up there and keep screaming about Obama's executive overreach on this immigration issue. Because my understanding is that, President Ronald Reagan did very similar things and nobody uttered a peep. I mean, so what's going on here?
I think that you're absolutely right that there's an unfortunate game of politics being played with millions of people's lives in this country. We need to find real, common sense, humane solutions to the crisis facing immigrant communities. We need to find ways to have people come out of the shadows and to be fully legally protected. The best way to do that is through changing the underlying law. But unfortunately, Congress, as you point out, has not acted. We need that to happen. And so here, the president took actions which, as constitutional law scholars, immigration law scholars, and other law professors and other former officials have highlighted, is a well-established power of the president. And here, Obama just merely used that power to prioritize his immigration policies and to allow for a common-sense short-term solution. But what you're right, we absolutely need to stop playing politics and find a long-term solution to the issues facing the millions of immigrants in this country.
Well, specifically, what this judge has done, and again, it does seem to be at the behest of the Republicans that's got them off the hook on Congress, because they have dug a hole for themselves with Boehner threatening to shut down or to defund Homeland Security and shut the government down and refusing to have a clean bill because of this issue, which they've tied to Homeland Security funding. It's really obviously put McConnell in a difficult position. It has led to senators like John McCain saying, this is ridiculous, we've got to do something about it. So they've really dug a hole for themselves. And this is, after all, a new Congress that came out of the gate saying that they were going to get things done. And they just looked worse than ever. And along comes this judge and gets them off the hook. But as far as I can see, the casualties of this are the 5 million undocumented immigrants, including children, which, you know, a lot of Democrats and some Republicans have said that, you know, the position that they're put in where their parents could be deported is unacceptable. So is there going to be a kind of moral backlash here?
There really should be. There really should be, because there is no excuse for this kind of playing politics with these individuals' lives. As you noted, some of the politicians who have at some times recognized that it would be good policy to regularize people's status are now not doing what's necessary to get legislation moving, not doing what's necessary to ensure that we can find a solution to the broken immigration system. So we absolutely think that this is not just a legal issue, but it is a moral issue as well.
So am I correct, though, in suggesting that perhaps that this showdown over shutting the government down over funding the Department of Homeland Security, do you think it's been, the Republicans in the House and Senate have gotten off the hook, or will it go ahead? I don't know quite what...
To answer your question, I don't know what's going to happen with this particular showdown. Perhaps this one might have been averted, but we believe that these policies will ultimately go into effect. And if the track record of what's happening or what's happened with budgets and the politics that gets played with those continues, then most assuredly, after these policies go into effect and after the courts uphold these policies, we'll likely see similar gamesmanship being played.
So, Nicholas Espiritu, since you have an amicus brief before the court in this case, Texas versus the United States, tell me about what your arguments are and when do you think they'll get heard?
Well, our arguments are essentially twofold. One is that the president's DACA, expanded DACA and DAPA programs are perfectly within his well-established legal power to do so. This position has been confirmed by Office of Legal Counsel memos. They've been confirmed by constitutional and immigration scholars. But the other part of our amicus brief is really focusing on the effect on immigrant communities. And here we really want the voices of immigrant communities to be heard and to let the court and the public know who is being affected and what needs to be done in order to ensure that these individuals are able to come out of the shadows and to participate fully in this society.
But it looks to me, though, Nicholas, that this thing is destined for the Supreme Court, and you know, it'll go back and forth with challenges. It could take some time, but do you think its ultimate destination is the Supreme Court?
It's undoubted that this is an issue of national significance, and that is one of the factors that the court looks at when deciding what cases to take. This is, and we should be realistic about that possibility. We are very confident that no matter what the Fifth Circuit does, an appeal, whether it's taken by the plaintiffs in this case or the defendants, will be taken to the Supreme Court, and there's a distinct possibility that the court would take this up.
So what would the timeline be, given that, you know, the lives of 5 million, a lot of people and a lot of children are at stake here?
Once again, it's difficult to determine. There's an expedited path that it could take where it could be in a scale of a few months. But oftentimes this might take a year or a year and a half to resolve in total. And it's very difficult to determine which one that's going to be from here without knowing what all the intermediate courts do.
So in terms of political blowback, I know you're dealing with the legal issues here, and you're not, obviously I'm asking you to be a political analyst, but it would seem to me just on the surface that this could ultimately backfire. And I mentioned George W. Bush, and he did appoint this judge who's come out with this ruling. You know, he did at least try to have immigration reform, and it got stalled, and it's been stalled ever since. But there are some Republicans who recognize that there is no, it's not particularly politically wise to alienate the fastest growing voting bloc in the United States, which is Latino voters. So what's your reading on that kind of political fallout and whether or not that's going to have an influence? I don't know whether it would have any influence on the Supreme Court because they've made such extraordinarily bizarre rulings of late, but in terms of the general politics in the country as we approach the 2016 elections, how do you think this is playing out?
Well, you know, as a young activist, I was involved in the fight against California's Proposition 187, which was a state law really targeting undocumented immigrants here that was brought and supported by the Republicans here in California. And in large part, it turned out to be the last hurrah for that political party's long-term chances in this state because of the demographic trends that you mentioned. And we believe that bad policy like this, voters aren't going to forget. Families who have family members who might be undocumented aren't going to forget. Communities who know the values of all members of their community, whether immigrant or not, aren't going to forget. And we think that there should be political blowback if one group or another is trying to make these kind of politics out of individuals' lives.
And does this in any way affect the Dreamers? It seems sort of the same issue, doesn't it? That you've got children in this country, and some of them going to college. and some even going into the military, whose parents are vulnerable to deportation.
Absolutely, absolutely. We're one of the key components which was put on hold was the program that was going to provide work permits and protection from deportation for the parents of U.S. citizen children and legal permanent resident children. This is the DAPA portion of the program. Even though this program wasn't slated to take effect until later in the year, if the appeals process drags on, we could see these kind of delays. And we could continue to see the kind of separation of families, which has been well documented. And we know the effects of the separation on children's school achievement, on their well-being, and the effect on the communities that these families originally came from. And so we're very, very concerned about the effects of delaying this program for the reasons that you mentioned.
Well, Nicholas Espiritu, I wish you all the best with your amicus brief in this case, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having us on.
And again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Espiritu, who's a staff attorney with the National Immigration Law Center, where he focuses on promoting the rights of low-income immigrants through litigation and administrative advocacy. He is on the amicus brief before the court in Texas versus the United States and has litigated several other cases that deal with immigration issues. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with Dr. Helen Caldicott.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Helen Caldicott, a physician, author, and anti-nuclear advocate who has founded several organizations, including Physicians for Social Responsibility, dedicated to opposing the use of nuclear power, depleted uranium munitions, nuclear weapons proliferation, and war. She was personally nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Nobel laureate Linus Pauling. And additionally, the Smithsonian Institute has named Dr. Caldicott as one of the most influential women of the 20th century. She has organized a major international symposium in New York approaching the fourth anniversary of the Fukushima disaster, the Helen Caldicott Foundation event symposium. The Dynamics of Possible Nuclear Extinction will take place February the 28th to March the 1st at the New York Academy of Medicine. And her latest book just out is Crisis Without End, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Catastrophe. Welcome to Background Briefing, Helen Caldicott.
Thank you, Ian.
And you are in Australia, but you'll be heading over here soon. So it's actually funny talking to you, Helen, because I can kind of imagine the scenery, what you're looking at, because I was recently in your hometown. So
yes, well, I'm looking out now. It's a lovely sunny day with fluffy white clouds. It's going to be 29 or 30 centigrade. I'm looking at my olive tree and my crepe myrtle flowering and my roses flowering and butterflies flying around the garden.
So your new book, Crisis Without End, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Catastrophe, it came out of a previous, I think on the second anniversary of the Fukushima disaster, there was an meeting in New York at the New York Academy of Medicine. Did you organize that, or were you one of the participants?
Yes, I did. And I got Naoto Kan, who was the Prime Minister at the time of the meltdowns, to speak at the symposium, and I got all the leading scientists of the world to discuss what was happening, oceanographers, biologists, physicians, all sorts of nuclear engineers, to discuss the whole ghastly catastrophe. And so it was really the first and only event, actually, that has occurred since the Fukushima disaster. Evolutionary biologists, that's what I was trying to think of. There's a wonderful man called Tim Rousseau who goes into the exclusion zones of both Fukushima and Chernobyl to examine the birds, the insects, the plants and animals. And he's seeing a very high incidence of mutations, of tumours, of cancers, of sterility in male birds, you name it, very small brains. And what happens to birds and animals happens to human beings. And his work is revolutionary and will change the attitude towards radiation and the standards of radiation to which international bodies now adhere. So it was a very important symposium, and the proceeds of that symposium were published by the New Press in the book Crisis Without End. And people, it's got 5 stars on Amazon, so I guess it's pretty okay.
It is okay, and I think the importance, Helen, is that one of the things I find extraordinary about nuclear power is that it has more lives than a cat. It's sort of like, you know, almost like the Terminator movie, with where you can't kill it off. It keeps coming back. I mean, after Three Mile Island, after Chernobyl, after Fukushima, you'd think it was dead and buried, but nevertheless, you know, the U.S. is, you know, trying to sell nuclear power plants to India at the moment, and there's a general campaign going on, which unfortunately some environmentalists have drunk the Kool-Aid, which is the idea that sort of nuclear power is the answer to global warming.
Yeah, nuclear Kool-Aid. Well, it's not, because nuclear power itself produces large quantities of global warming gases, including CO2, CFCs. I've written all about that in the first chapter of my book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer, because nuclear power plants don't stand alone. They're undergirded by a massive industrial infrastructure, mining, milling, enrichment, making the fuel rods, manufacturing the rods, building the reactor, storing the radioactive waste for a million years. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And so the nuclear industry lies, as it always has and always will. And I hate to say it, Ian, but I've said for many years that the only way nuclear power will stop, and also the nuclear arms race, which is what this next symposium is about, is if there's a big meltdown in America and hundreds of thousands of people are contaminated and people are dying of acute radiation illness within 2 weeks of exposure, vomiting and bleeding to death, and then epidemics of cancer and leukemia developing years later. I don't think that Americans really give much thought to Russians dying, and certainly that was the case during Chernobyl when I was interviewed on American radio quite often. They said, but they're just Russians. Over a million people now have died as a result of Chernobyl in Belarus, Ukraine, Western Russia, and Europe. And then there's Fukushima. Well, that's a big cover-up. The government has just passed law to say that anyone who reports well on Fukushima could be jailed for 10 years. The doctors have been told not to tell their patients that their disease may be related to radiation. There's a huge cover-up. Already, over 100 children have developed thyroid cancer in the Fukushima prefecture, and the incidence of thyroid cancer in children under the age of 18 or 17 is 1 in a million or 2 in a million. So there's a huge cover-up going on there, and Japanese people dying. Well, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that happened to save American lives. So unless there's a major catastrophe in America, I think the nuclear industry, which is so powerful and so supported by the Congress, who are really nuclear prostitutes in a way, they've been funded by the nuclear industry and the weapons industry, I don't think anything will happen. So we're at a sort of crisis turning point, and that's why I've now organised this symposium, which is to be held again at the New York Academy of Medicine on February the 28th, March the 1st, which is a weekend, titled The Dynamics of Possible Nuclear Extinction. The reason I was impelled to do this, Ian, was that I read an article in the Atlantic Monthly some months ago, quoting Stephen Hawking and others, saying that computers are becoming very autonomous. Within about 10 years, they will take over almost all jobs that humans now have, including planting food and processing food and harvesting food, doing everything. They will become autonomous, so they may be able to reproduce themselves. You can't put moral conscience into a computer, program conscience or morality. And they were saying, Hawking et al., that they're worried that computers themselves could start a nuclear war. And I thought, oh, my God, I've never heard of this. So I thought, I better do something about it. So I've organized this symposium, and Hawking may well say a few words to introduce it. And then we get into all the problems related to why there could be a nuclear war, including a situation in the Ukraine, which is incredibly dangerous because for the first time Russia and America are confronting each other militarily. Russia's been conducting nuclear drills, preparing for nuclear war right across Russia. America probably has too. Obama said he'll spend $1 trillion in the next 30 years to replace every single nuclear weapon delivery system to make them more accurate, which is crazy. We've got a very, very hawkish Congress now and Senate, which really scares the bejesus out of me, because McCain, who's never seen a war he didn't like or want to get into, even though he was in a tiger's cage in Vietnam for a long time and tortured, I really worry about the fate of the Earth at the moment. The military-industrial complex are very pleased about what is happening in the Ukraine because they can make more weapons. And I've got people covering what the labs are up to, anthropologists discussing the motivation of people in labs who manufacture and design nuclear weapons. In Lawrence Livermore, young men aged 20 to 30 who are really Aspergerish but brilliant, who drink Coke and eat ice cream all day and have no relationships except with their computer screens. Some of them are the main designers of nuclear weapons. What's the pathology within society that mitigates promotes the development of the global gas oven? Let's be frank, that's what we're doing. And then we've got wonderful meteorologist called Robock, Alan Robock, who did the initial studies on nuclear winter, and if there's a nuclear war, the Earth will be covered with a cloud so thick it will block out the sun for up to 10 years, and we and everything else will freeze to death in the dark. He's speaking. If there's a small nuclear war between India and Pakistan with only 100 nuclear weapons, we'd get nuclear autumn, crops would fail, and billions would die of starvation. These things are not attended to by the media, never discussed, as we hurtle like lemmings towards the nuclear precipice.
And again, I'm speaking with Helen Caldicott, who's a physician, author, and anti-nuclear advocate, who founded several organizations, including Physicians for Social Responsibility, dedicated to opposing the use of nuclear power, depleted uranium munitions, nuclear weapons proliferation, and war. She was personally nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Nobel laureate Linus Pauling. And additionally, the Smithsonian Institute has named Dr. Caldicott as one of the most influential women of the 20th century. She has organized a major international symposium in New York approaching the fourth anniversary of the Fukushima disaster, and the Helen Caldicott Foundation event symposium, The Dynamics of Possible Nuclear Extinction, will take place between February the 28th and March the 1st at the New York Academy of Medicine. And her latest book just out is Crisis Without End, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Catastrophe. And some of the people that you've got at your symposium, Helen, are people that I speak to often. Theodore Postel, who's kind of the go-to guy when you really want to understand what's going on with the weapons and weapons delivery systems and the various times that occasions that the Pentagon lies about the testing. I mean, one of the amazing things about the military-industrial complex, it's so corrupt that you don't even have to make weapons nowadays that work. That's not even like the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, which is the most expensive weapon system in history. It doesn't work. But it doesn't matter. They keep building it. Bill Hartung, again, I speak to him often, and Mike Lofgren, a wonderful analyst of the antics on Capitol Hill, Bob Scheer, a colleague here at KPFK, Noam Chomsky, etc. So it's really obviously going to be a very impressive event. Now, let's just go back to Fukushima, though, because there was a 60 Minutes piece recently that just scared the hell out of me, because the meltdowns have created these hot zones. They can, as far as I know, they're still pouring tons of water on those reactors to this day. And of course, that water becomes contaminated and gets stored, or some of it seeps into the ocean. And vast tracts of land are absolutely finished, can't be tilled. And this was a very rich agricultural area before this happened. And there are these ghost towns as well. But the secrecy element is so extraordinary. And what's your understanding of how the Japanese people are handling this? Are they simply kept in the dark?
Yes. There's denial, but there's tremendous obfuscation of the facts. Secrecy, in fact, Abe, the Prime Minister, has just passed a secrecy law saying that any journalist who really reports on Fukushima could be jailed for 10 years. The doctors have been told not to tell their patients their symptoms and diseases are related to radiation, if they are. The farmers in Fukushima are being encouraged to grow their rice again and their food, a very rich agricultural area, and there are big sort of food shows in London and elsewhere promoting food from Fukushima. If the rice is too radioactive, they mix it with non-radioactive rice to dilute the radiation effect. Over 100 children have developed thyroid cancer in the Fukushima prefecture, and the incidence of thyroid cancer in children is only 1 or 2 per million. That's the tip of the iceberg, because they developed it really early. Children are very radiosensitive, but that means there'll be thousands or hundreds of thousands more cases of cancer, which are all being covered up. The IAEA, with the Fukushima Hospital, is building another big cancer hospital in Fukushima, which indicates everything. It says everything, really. And the IAEA is really involved in what is going on in Japan and covering up. The nuclear power industry in America is encouraging the Japanese to reopen their reactors. They're all closed down at the moment. The Japanese are very big promoters and manufacturers of huge parts for nuclear reactors, which they export all over the world, including the reactor vessel. And they're selling reactor parts to Turkey and I think United Arab Emirates. So it's a huge ecological and economic issue for the Japanese, and they're very good at denying stuff, the Japanese. It's a very interesting society. I've been there 3 times in the last year, speaking to huge audiences of parents, and I go through the medical ramifications of eating radioactive food and inhaling radioactive air and children being so sensitive and little girls more sensitive than little boys, the whole thing. And then comes question time, and it turns into a consultation. A woman will stand up and say, does radiation concentrate in breast milk? Or, my son has diarrhea and he's got a bleeding nose. What does that mean? And it's so sad. When I finish, parents come rushing up to me so grateful that I've told the truth, even though it's an awful truth. They want to know the truth. And they're not being told, they're being kept in the dark. It's really ghastly, Ian.
Well, what's extraordinary about Fukushima and how it unfolded and why it was made worse was because TEPCO, the company, the Tokyo Power Company, they just lied to the government. It seems that in Japan, these monopolies are more powerful than the government itself.
Well, TEPCO is the government, let's be frank. That's called the nuclear priesthood in America, but it's the same in Japan, and they kind of run the government, and the government is now subsidizing TEPCO to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. They want to keep TEPCO afloat no matter what. 7,000 workers are present every day at the reactors. They're being heavily irradiated, and they're collected by subcontractors, including the Yakuza, who are the Japanese mafia, and they take homeless men from the streets in Tokyo, etc., alcoholics, mentally sick people, and they're working at Fukushima not to stabilize anything, but to kind of keep the whole thing afloat and not get any worse. There was an earthquake 7 on the Richter scale yesterday, or 6.9, just off the coast of Fukushima, which could be terribly dangerous. Every day, 400 tons of radioactive water are emitted into the Pacific, and that's been happening since the reactors melted down 3 years ago. And is it 3 years or four? Nearly 4 years ago now. And so the Pacific, although it's a huge body of water and the radiation becomes diluted, the solution to pollution by dilution is fallacious when it comes to radiation, because the radiation reconcentrates in the food chain by orders of magnitude in the algae and then in the crustaceans that eat the algae and then the little fish that eat the crustaceans and the big fish. And then we stand at the apex of the food chain. So these isotopes, cesium-137, 134, plutonium, americium, neptunium, strontium, tritium, and there are over 100 such radioactive elements, most of which are never mentioned in the media. They all concentrate in various organs of the body, and it takes from 2 to 80 years to develop a cancer once the cells have been irradiated, and no cancer identifies its origin, saying, I was made by some cesium you ate in a piece of fish in a sushi restaurant in New York 20 years ago. But we know absolutely for sure that radiation induces cancer. No radiation is safe. It's cumulative. Each dose you get adds to your risk of getting cancer. Do not have CT scans unless it's absolutely indicated, because you get a high dose of radiation from them. Don't walk through radiation monitors in the airports. Each dose of radiation you get adds to your risk of getting cancer. Do not get your teeth x-rayed every year. It's absolutely unnecessary. My ex-husband was a radiologist. They make a lot of money. So be careful. And doctors are not gods. If they say you need an x-ray, well, often we do it for defensive purposes. Ask them why. Make them tell you why and all the details.
Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back and continuing the conversation with Dr. Helen Caldicott.
But the atoms here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia, and whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military atom, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. A whole less truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the conversation with Dr. Helen Caldicott, a physician, author, and anti-nuclear advocate. Her latest book just out is Crisis Without End, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Catastrophe, and she'll be holding a symposium. It's called Symposium, The Dynamics of Possible Nuclear Extinction in New York at the New York Academy of Medicine from February the 28th to March the 1st. Now, you mentioned earlier, Helen, about how much Japan is in the nuclear business and how they build parts for nuclear plants. They did build parts for the nuclear plant down here at San Onofre, south of Los Angeles, and they didn't fit. And the whole thing sort of shuddered like a bootlegger's still in the mountains of Appalachia. And eventually they had to shut the thing down. And a lot of anti-nuclear activists were involved in forcing the issue. And finally, they literally have closed down San Onofre. And there are a lot of nuclear activists are also trying to close down the Diablo Canyon.
Diablo Canyon.
Because
it's named after the devil, which is so interesting.
I know, and they've just found another earthquake fault underneath it. So short of what you were saying earlier, that it may take a catastrophe to wake the American people up, because the nuclear establishment is so powerful, and as we were saying earlier, for reasons that still mystify me, they're able to continue in the face of continual catastrophes that just happen every often, and the price that are paid is so obviously greater than the benefits that they tout. So short of a catastrophe, it would seem that those, at least the case of San Onofre, indicates that public pressure can work.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I think Diablo Canyon will be closed down shortly too. It's imperative that it is, because hundreds of thousands of people would be affected, if not millions, because California is full of people. but it's got to happen universally. And as I said earlier, you know, only a meltdown, I think a really big meltdown in America, could close down the whole industry and give people such a shock that it just happens automatically. And then that will have repercussions upon the nuclear weapons industry, which is also incredibly powerful. I don't know what else to do, Ian. I've tried my best for 43 years and education. And indeed, we got close to closing down the whole nuclear arms race in the 80s. When I came to America in 78, most people I spoke to said it's better to be dead than red, and I thought, this is psychotic. They'd rather die in a nuclear war. So I mobilized physicians for social responsibility, got 23,000 doctors involved, and we taught people the medical consequences of nuclear war. We got a lot of media exposure, and in 5 years, 80% of Americans became opposed to the concept of nuclear war and wanted the arms race to end. That was the Freeze Movement, 80%. We got 1 million people in Central Park in June 82, biggest rally ever in the history of America. And Reagan and Gorbachev worked together to end the Cold War. We handed it to Clinton on a silver plate that he could have flown over to Yeltsin in Air Force One and said, Boris, we're going to sign this agreement to abolish nuclear weapons now, as what nearly happened in Reykjavik when Reagan and Gorbachev met over a weekend and almost agreed to abolish nuclear weapons. It could have happened, but Clinton had no spine and no guts, and he didn't do it. And if there's a nuclear war tonight, which there could be, I mean, I'm going to Boston on Friday, and I don't know if I'll come home. It's tenuous as that with Russia and America and the Ukraine now. It will be Clinton's legacy.
Well, I think Bush Senior preceded him. He didn't pick up on what Reagan had done.
Well, no, Bush was quite good. He got Bush the first,
right,
or George the first. He got rid of some tactical nuclear weapons in Europe unilaterally to help Gorbachev, so he could bring weapons from the Ukraine and other provinces back to Moscow and Russia so he could supervise them. So George I wasn't so bad, but it was Clinton who dropped the ball and the silver plate that we gave him, silver platter.
And continued the eastward expansion of NATO, which has led to the situation in Crimea. And by the way,
that will be addressed in this conference, the Ukrainian situation, the eastward expansion of NATO, instigated by Norman Augustin at Lockheed Martin, because no country can join NATO without militarizing up to billions of dollars, and of course then you buy Lockheed Martin equipment. So it was all orchestrated. Norman Augustin went to these little countries, Lithuania, etc., and encouraged them to join NATO, saying they'd have a democracy.
And and we were saying earlier that, you know, they're selling planes that don't work too, on top of that. But meanwhile, Russia has built up, I think Russia now has more nuclear weapons than the United States, and you have a really dangerous...
Well, we don't know. We actually don't know, because the U.S. has weapons in cupboards, in storage, ready to use if necessary. But each country has over 1,000 hydrogen bombs, and the Russian bombs are very big, targeted on each country. I mean, New York has over 10 hydrogen bombs targeted on it as we speak.
Well, the thing that frightens me, though...
Actually, it was 40. Robert McNamara and I wrote an article for the LA Times on that. 40. I mean, you know, they talk about terrorists. Where are their heads?
Right.
In the sand.
Well, but I was going to say, Helen, that what scares the hell out of me, particularly with the situation as being so incendiary in Crimea and in Ukraine, is that, you know, Russia is now a kleptocracy, a gangster state, and Putin is the mafia boss. And you have this unusual combination now of national security and organized crime, the mafia and nuclear weapons. It's never been that dangerous ever. I mean, it's bad enough having them in the hands of so-called, you know, Western leaders, but this is a scary situation.
It is scary indeed, and he's having nuclear weapons drills. He had one last week right across Russia. But, you know, let's talk about America. Over the last year or so, over 70, 80 men who are officers manning the missile silos in America have been fired because they take drugs, they cheat on their tests, they go to sleep on the job. Those missile silos operate with floppy disks and telephones that often don't work. I mean, if you want to really get scared, look at what's happening over there in America. In America.
Right, under the prairies of Wyoming, etc. So
Wyoming, South Dakota, Colorado. You fly over, you can look down and see the missile silos as you fly over them, with weapons ready to blow up the world. And little boys aged 18 to 21, each armed with a pistol, one to shoot the other if one shows signs of deviant behavior. Well, the deviant one obviously might get the upper hand. And there are locks 12 feet apart so that one man can't turn both keys, but they've worked out a string trick where you tie a piece of string on one key and one man can turn both locks. I mean, we're in a very... very tenuous situation. God knows what's happening in the Russian missile silos.
So, Dr. Helen Caldicott, again, she is the author of the brand new book just out, Crisis Without End, the Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Catastrophe. We're very grateful, Dr. Helen Caldicott, particularly given how little attention has been paid to Fukushima and to Japan after these extraordinary meltdowns. Four reactors, a fifth almost went up to. I think one of them was NOx, wasn't it? Fueled by this plutonium hybrid additive.
Yes, it had. Yes, that was reactor three. And in fact, that did have a nuclear explosion. They called it an excursion. It had a hydrogen explosion plus a nuclear explosion. They think it was in the spent fuel pool, but they don't know. And so pieces of spent fuel rods with plutonium and everything else in it have been found kilometres away from the reactors. I mean, there's a huge story in this which really has only just been partially uncovered.
Well, but you've looked into all of this stuff in the book. That's why I think the book's very valuable, because...
Yes, as much as we possibly could, about the radioactive fish in the Pacific and about... how the accidents happen and how the reactors were built just at the seaside of a huge range of mountains, and water pours down from the mountains every day under the reactors. And when they were intact, that was fine. But now there have been three meltdowns, probably into the earth. The water washes over the reactor molten cores and becomes radioactive itself and becomes radioactive waste itself. And that 400 tonnes pours into the Pacific every day. Meanwhile, you're right, they're pouring seawater into the reactors to try and keep the cores cool so there's not further melting of the radioactive lava. And then they collect that water, which is incredibly radioactive, and store it in over 1,000 huge tanks, three stories high. The tanks are only built to last 5 years. If there's an earthquake near there, the tanks would all collapse and all of that water would pour into the Pacific. They're running out of room for the tanks.
But, you know, we've had incidents here up in Northern California where, you know, fishing boats, like empty, you know, ghost ships have shown up on the California shore from Fukushima. In Vancouver, British Columbia, sneakers and pieces of feet have shown up. I mean, So you have to assume that all of that radioactivity has migrated across to the United States.
Yeah.
So again, I'm speaking with Dr. Helen Caldicott, the author of the brand new book just out, Crisis Without End, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Catastrophe. Just in the last couple of minutes here, what would your pitch be, since I'm a terrible salesman and I don't know that you're a great salesperson, but you're certainly a great messenger and an inspiration to motivate people to recognize.
Well, I guess I'd speak to people as a pediatrician. If you love your children, if you love your grandchildren, if you love the roses and the wisteria, if you love this planet, you will come to this symposium or live stream it on the 28th of February and the 1st of March and learn about the possibility of nuclear extinction. You will get the book, Crisis Without End, and learn about Fukushima and apply that to all your reactors in America. You will then decide, after you've gone through the stages of grief, shock and disbelief, depression, and in your angry phase, you will rise up like a phoenix and decide that you will change America and save the planet. That's not out of the question, because actually I led the movement in America against nuclear weapons. I was a little rusty American Australian physician. I was only about 40, and I was an alien, and I was a woman. So, look, if I could do it, you can do it. Anyone can do it. You just decide that's what you're going to do, and you do it, no matter what. If a door closes in front of you, you go in the back door. You break in. You go and see your congressman. You go and see your senators. You threaten them with, you know, they won't be elected next time. You'll door knock the whole neighborhood. You'll educate them. You will get to see the president. You will get on television. You will do what is necessary. What is necessary to save the planet? Just think, if your child was diagnosed with leukemia, would you sell your house, get the money, go to the Mayo Clinic, do everything you possibly could to save that child's life? And if that child dies, you will never recover. Multiply that by 7 billion people.
Well, Helen, I'm afraid I'm not afraid, but I don't think we can keep you any longer. I know you've got to get ready to leave Australia to come to the United States, and I thank you so much for joining us.
That's a pleasure. Thank you very much, Ian. Bye-bye.
And again, I've been speaking with Helen Caldicott, who's a physician, author, and anti-nuclear advocate, who has founded several organizations, including Physicians for Social Responsibility, dedicated to opposing the use of nuclear power, depleted uranium munitions, nuclear weapons proliferation, and war. She was personally nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Nobel laureate Linus Pauling. And additionally, the Smithsonian Institute has named Dr. Caldicott as one of the most influential women of the 20th century. She has organized a major international symposium in New York approaching the 4th anniversary of the Fukushima disaster. The Helen Caldicott Foundation event symposium, The Dynamics of Possible Nuclear Extinction, will take place February the 28th to March the 1st at the New York Academy of Medicine. And her latest book just out is Crisis Without End, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Catastrophe. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.